Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkang namassami. So tonight is the full moon of December, the last full moon of 2012. And as is the custom throughout Buddhist countries around the globe, and since the time of the Buddha, and in fact even before the Buddha, people who are intent on spiritual practice have come here to the monastery tonight and have taken, many of you have taken the eight precepts. And as I said, this is a tradition even before the time of the Buddha. There were many sects and different traditions that kept this practice where they would gather together in their different gathering places and take on extra practices on the half moons, full moons, new moons, and half moons, so basically every once a week or so. And it was requested of the Buddha that, as other people were doing this at the time of the Buddha, it seemed to be a good thing that the Buddha take on a similar practice, and the Buddha consented. And ever since then, lay people have been coming to the monastery to take this kind of practice on. In Thailand, it's a bit more intense a practice. So I just remember, say, in Ban Bung Wai, which is in Ubon, in the northeast of Thailand, it's quite a day. So in the morning, the lay people don't come to the temple in the evening in the way that we do here. But since it's a farming community, the lay people will go to the monastery usually, say, 7 o'clock or so, and everyone seemed to look rather old. It's kind of old people, and it's not so much that they were all old, it's just that they were very weathered because they were farmers. It was a farming community. And so these kind of deep lines on the faces and kind of slouched over, and they'd walk to the temple carrying the little kind of woven basket of sticky rice often. And I just have this image of these old ladies and men kind of walking into the monastery, slightly slouched over, white hair, and very radiant usually. And it was a kind of a festive day. And they'd come to the monastery. And in the morning, there'd be 20, 30, 40 people, men and women. Like I said, they seemed old, but they were, of course, in all age groups. And in the kitchen, there'd be a lot of talking. And Ajahn Jayasaro would often, I remember, have to kind of encourage them again and again to watch their speech, and they would laugh and giggle and kind of say how hard it was and continue on with their kind of chatter. And they'd cook food for the monks and they'd offer it to the monks, and then they'd spend the whole day. They take on the eight precepts, which you've done tonight, most of you. And they spend that day, it's kind of like a religious observance. And the eight precepts are kind of based on the five precepts, which is the basic moral code for Buddhists, say, on a regular basis, is just kind of the foundation of spiritual practice in Buddhist teaching is the five precepts. So the five precepts are to refrain from killing, so sort of a reverence for what it means to be alive, that for beings everywhere, of every shape and form, of every size, all beings are similar to ourselves. They have this basic structure of a body. They're sensitive. They see. They hear. and they're afraid of death. You see this with even the smallest creatures, like an ant. You know, if you kind of put your finger in front of an ant and make it known that you're there, you can just see the kind of panic. It kind of starts running around and kind of moving to the right, moving to the left, and clearly afraid. And that's not, you know, I remember, you know, old philosophers in the 18th century, Descartes. If you were, you know, Descartes said something like, if you were to torture a dog and he whines and reacts, it's just simply the motion of the way a clock ticks, and it's just the mechanics of the dog, and there's nothing, there's no soul, and there's nothing they're actually experiencing pain, which to modern sensitivities and to the Buddha's teachings is simply madness. All beings feel and they value their existence and their freedom. And that's something to be respected. And so the first precept is to value that, the life of all beings, and to not kill. And the second precept, not to steal. It's phrased in a nice way, not to refrain from taking that which is not given. And this is nice because that way it also applies to monks and monastics, monks or nuns. Monastics have, the moral code is basically based on the same principle, but the monastic code is simply refined. And so for a monk, a monastic, we're not allowed to take anything that is not offered into our hands. So if you put a juice in front of me and some apple juice, and it's not put into my hands, I cannot simply help myself to it. And that renders the monastic very vulnerable. We have to rely on the generosity of lay people. We can't simply, start growing our own food. We can't simply help ourselves to something that might be around. It's basically, we are in a dependent relationship. It's a relationship that is maintained through this dependency of the monastic. We can't just cut ourselves off into a cocoon, hide away, grow our own food, and live as complete recluses. We have to have this relationship. And a relationship is something that always goes two ways. It's not just that it's a one-way relationship. Relationships that are just one way become dead very quickly. And if that's the case, I think the lay people would fail to gain nourishment and support from the monastic's existence if there wasn't a kind of giving on the behalf of the monastic as well. For the giving of the monastic, that has to be grounded in two aspects. One is in our own sincere practice. We have to be really dedicated to what we're doing. And if lay people see that, if they see that we're serious about what we're doing, we're intent on the goal, we're sincere in our love for the Dhamma, for the teachings, then that will be inspiring and it will be seen as something worthy of support. But the monastic has a duty as they get more senior to share what they've learned through their own practice with the laity. And the teachings are something, it's a very specific teaching. The Buddha had something, he didn't just say some similes and parables and just encourage us to be good people. He had a very precise teaching that he was trying to communicate. And it's not something that's easily grasped, and certainly not something you can grasp through simply reading some books. So taking what is not given, the second precept, and it's nicely phrased, so it applies both to monastics, and for a layperson, it simply means not to steal, respecting the domain of other people's property and possessions and respecting their space. You could extend this to really appreciating the not taking advantage of other people and appreciating their rights and the dignity of their own space, which should not be invaded. The third precept, in the five precepts, the third precept is to not engage in sexual misconduct. This is, I think, the way this is best understood is to understand that because sexual activity, there's in, say, the physical, the highest physical experience of pleasure, perhaps for the human beings in sexual activity, it can be very addictive, it can be very seductive, and it can be very easy to hurt other people through our sexual activity, either through dishonesty, affairs, or some kind of forced sexual activity, and that simply can be very hurtful, and that's the foundation of this rule is to not, or this precept, is to not engage in sexual activity that causes suffering to other people. Or one might say also that involves deceit, because that's breaking another precept. If to simply think that you can, say, have an affair, but nobody knows about it, therefore it's not really hurting anybody, that's not the case. And if you look at your own heart, and if that's happening, you kind of recognize, you know, this has to stop. There's no way that my heart can be at peace while you're living a double life. It cannot be. At the end of the day, if our heart is going to be at peace, is going to be free, it has to come to a state of wholeness where we're living a whole, we're committed to something and we're living it wholly and completely. So you have a partner and you're committed to that partner either wholly or completely, or you're not. And this can be an ideal. This is also something that sometimes we might look in our hearts and we haven't actually committed any, you know, we haven't had an affair or anything like that, but we recognize in our heart that it's not completely committed to the partner that we're living with. And so how do you deal with that? And that's the process of life. That's the growing experience and where we have to learn how to communicate with our partner to have a, use the relationship that we're in so that we can develop a deeper understanding of ourselves and of the other and of what love is and of what commitment is. And that's a kind of process of learning. So we can't be hard on ourselves for finding that we look inside our heart and it's kind of split and it's contradictory and we're not really sure and it's a jangle and a mumble of contradictions. That's the state of the human condition for the vast majority of us. And so we shouldn't be hard on ourselves, but at the same time we have to recognize that we have to respond to that and to nurture a sense of healing the contradictions. Because it's only through healing these contradictions that the heart can ever find rest. And the fourth precept in the five precepts is to refrain from false speech. And we nicely kind of borrow part of the Eightfold Path and we bring in the what we just chanted tonight, false and harmful speech. But I think of, in terms of, again, spiritual truth, what we're looking for in our spiritual path is, or spiritual practice, one way of expressing it is the realization of truth. We want to get to a point where we have such a trust in truth that we know that it's through truthfulness that we're going to make progress towards that which is real. Whatever real reality is, on the one hand, we should recognize that there is delusion in our hearts. We don't know reality. We don't know what is real, what is true. But we trust that there is such a thing as truth out there. We trust that there is a way that things are, And that if we can align our hearts with that, that's got to be the right thing. You know, that's got to be what our life should be all about, is finding that which is true, that which is real, that which is authentically trustworthy and valuable. And obviously, if we are willing to let the heart move into falseness and so this commitment to truthfulness, you know, it's another expression of this, is a commitment to authenticity. And that's just a refinement of truthfulness. And again, authenticity, you can't be idealistic with yourself. That's not a state, that's a process. That's something that you achieve through time, effort, practice, failing, and reestablishing that commitment to being who you really are, to being honest. The fifth precept is the refraining from drugs and alcohol. Again, the way it's phrased, drugs and alcohol, which lead to carelessness. So this, of the five precepts, this is the only one which is not technically a moral precept. It's not that drugs and alcohol cause pain and suffering to others directly, but simply drugs and alcohol have such a devastating effect on the heart that it can wind up causing enormous suffering to others. And you just think about all the four other moral precepts, all those that are broken around the world, all the crimes, all the murders, all the affairs and all the falsities and so forth, and what relationship they all have to alcohol or drugs. It's very direct, I think. So that's the five precepts, the kind of foundation of the Buddhist practice. And on these half moon days, as I was saying, in Thailand, people will come to the monastery and they'll take the eight precepts. And the eight precepts is just simply a refinement on the five precepts, but it's moving more towards not just the practice of, say, virtue, but it's also the practice of renunciation and simplicity. So you take on the third precept, refraining from sexual misconduct, is changed to refraining from sexual activity for one day out of 7 days. You practice celibacy just for one day as an intentional kind of determination. And not that there's sexual activity is immoral by any means, it's just simply that on this one day we're going to practice celibacy. Just like the Buddha says, just like the enlightened ones in the world, those who are free from greed, hatred, and delusion, are naturally celibate. This is a natural extension of that understanding of the freedom from the heart. For one day we will imitate, as it were, and live just like the noble ones live. We will be free from sexual activity. And then we also add onto the five precepts three more precepts of renunciation. So one is to refrain from eating after midday. So in Thailand, in the northeast, in Ubon, Ratchathani, in Wat Nanachat, and most of the forest monasteries, what this means is simply one meal a day. And it's funny, because you come to the West, and lay people sometimes, you talk about this precept, and they can really kind of, you know, it just sounds so difficult. And we give retreats sometimes, and this notion of refraining from eating in the afternoon is kind of a big deal. And it's remarkable, because when you've never done it before, it sounds kind of challenging. Just a few reflections on that. One, it's nowhere near as difficult as people think. And two, I think it's also nice to reflect on this, even if it were difficult. Let's remember that a substantial portion of the planet, of the human population, is going to bed every day hungry. And those are our brothers and sisters, part of the human family. Tonight we'll be hungry. And what's it like to be hungry? And we should have some familiarity with something like that. It's a personal opinion. just to out of kind of honoring what other people are experiencing, like all over the globe, even in America, even the richest country in the world. And so to help kind of create a sense of empathy and recognition of what other beings who are less fortunate than ourselves, it kind of helps create a bond, a sense of, right, you know, other beings are experiencing this. Not that you have to suffer through hunger. And I think it is possible to, of course it's possible to be hungry and not to suffer over that, not to create a problem with it. But that takes spiritual practice and spiritual understanding and spiritual virtue. So through just having one meal a day or just eating in the morning, it's a simple process. You don't have to worry about washing the dishes in the evening. You don't have to worry about cooking food and just have your meal. You're done with it. Kind of the whole day is free. Then the seventh precept is refraining from entertainment, beautification, and adornment. And again, these are just sort of almost aspects of individuality, of expression of who we, of self, you know, and you come to the monastery, and ideally, a monastery is not a place where we're comparing ourselves, you know, he's kind of bigger, more muscular than me, or she's prettier than I am. Why is my nose so big? Whatever, these kind of things. We come to the monastery and it's just not the point. We put all that down, the kind of comparing of, you know, seeking, looking at people in ways of kind of judging them and comparing ourselves and trying to be attractive. That's in the monastery, that doesn't, you're welcome to, you know, do what you want, but in the monastery, that's not the modus operandi of a monastic life. There's nothing wrong with being attractive. You don't have to try and look ugly when you come to a monastery. But this sort of precept is kind of just simplicity. You know, coming to a monastery, just being what you are, trying not to be better or in any way than anybody else, just being what you are. Entertainment, worldly entertainment, TV, novels, computers, that sort of thing. For one day, we put that down. And it's a practice that is also very good for monastics to do as well. This is one area where we have computer use, and it's something that can easily become one outlet where we can kind of encounter the world, encounter the news, for instance. And it's good to put that down for at least one day of the week. And then lastly is to not lie in a higher luxurious sleeping place. So to, again, just the simplicity of sleeping on the floor. It's just sort of like a form of renunciation. In the Buddha's days specifically, the high and luxurious bed was seen as a sort of fancy kind of sign of royalty or the upper class. And so this practice of sleeping on a very simple sleeping place is, again, it's just a gesture of renunciation for one day of the week. It's part of a practice of simplicity, developing simplicity, cultivating simplicity. Recognizing that these living simply is okay. You don't need a whole lot in life to be happy. Happiness does not rely on luxury or comfort. It doesn't rely, ideally, it's not about being beautiful or having, you know, nice clothing. Happiness and freedom are affairs of the heart, which comes about through practice, Buddhist practice, or spiritual practice. So when you took the precepts and you started off with taking refuge in the triple gem, so that's the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And even those who have been, you know, Buddhists for years, this is always good just to come back and ask yourself, what does that mean? So what is the Buddha? What is the Dhamma? What is the Sangha? And what does it mean to take refuge in these things? Um, So it's nice to review this. Maybe the best way to understand the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I'll start with the word Dhamma. It's hard to explain Dhamma. It's a difficult word to translate because it has different nuances. I think a nice way of understanding it or thinking about it, especially when you, in terms of refuge, it's in the way things are. It's the way things are. It's the truth of the way things are. So Dhamma is something which what is there, whether you understand it or not, whether you realize it or not. It's whether Buddhas arise in the world and teach it and explain it. It's there. It's the way things are. And at the same time, it's just like the saying that we have in the West. I'm actually not sure the origin of this, but the truth will set you free. Where is that from? Can't remember. Truth will set you free. And that's something that applies to the Buddhist teachings in a very real way. Dhamma also refers to, it's that which the Buddha taught. So the Buddha, he starts off with him realizing the way things are, the nature of reality, the nature of fundamental truths of existence. And then he taught that. He taught the people the way things are and the nature of, say, reality on a highest level. He likened it, he said it's like an ancient city, kind of made of stone, kind of deep in the forest, which has been long abandoned and grown old, and it's empty, and it's covered in moss and trees and vegetation. And a man were to stumble across that city and see it and to realize its existence, and he goes back to the king and says, King, I've discovered this great city, and you should make a path into that great city and bring it back to life. And the Buddha says that's like what he's done with the Four Noble Truths. He's come across the Four Noble Truths. He's realized the Four Noble Truths, and he's brought it back into teaching. He's brought it back to the world of humans through teaching them. So these Four Noble Truths, this is a nice way to kind of summarize the essence, the heart of the Buddha's teachings, the essence of the Dhamma, the essence of the way things are. And the way things are, I mean, it's a kind of funny statement because so many different aspects of reality, and most people, we live in our own worlds, and we create delusions and beliefs and opinions, and because there's such a bewildering variety of opinions, we've kind of come to this notion that anybody who says that this is the way things are, then that just sounds dogmatic and insane almost, to think that you've discovered the truth of the way things are. In a world of postmodernism, it seems like a ridiculous claim almost. And in fact, before I became a monk, it was almost a sign that this is something not to trust. Anybody who says they think they know the way things are, it's something you just don't trust that. Seems ridiculous. But I'd like to say there's something about the Four Noble Truths that are unique and special, and it resonates with the heart, at least my heart, very deeply. And when I think about spiritual life and spiritual purpose, why is it that I'm a monk? What is it that I'm searching for in life? And to me, it's always been clear to me, even as a young child, that suffering is the main question of human existence. And why is it that we suffer? And what is suffering all about? And how is it that we get into this situation? I remember asking my mother this as a young boy, and I'd watch TV, and there'd be these Christian programs on fundraising for, say, famines that were happening in Africa, and you'd see these images of these young children with these bloated bellies and these kind of toothpick limbs and with tears and flies in their face. And I'd just be in tears and ask my mom, why is it that this happens? And the answer that she would give with not knowing, she was, well, God works in strange ways. And I guess that seemed like a strange reply. But as a Buddhist, that's not the case, that everything arises through causes and conditions. But especially what the point is here, that suffering is the most important question in life. Why is it that we suffer, and what is suffering, and what is the nature of suffering, and what is the origin of suffering? And this is what the Four Noble Truths are all about. So the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. And when you look at the facts, the bare facts of the human existence, we have a body, and we have a mind, and we have sensory experience. And we grow up, and we develop ideas. We're taught things. We inherit things from our culture. And through our experience, we create a sense of likes and dislikes, and we like certain things, and we dislike other things. We create senses of possession. I'm told that this car belongs to me, this little toy car belongs to me. And if you take it, I'm angry because it's mine. We're told that a country belongs to us, it's our country. And if other people come and take it, then they've invaded our country. We're told certain things are valuable, so we're told that if we have a big house, then that's really important, and it makes us an important person, perhaps. Or we have a powerful job, then we feel powerful. And all of these things are just creations of the mind. They're agreements, they're conventions that we create in our minds and we believe in. And at the end of the day, we go to war at times for these simply things that exist in our minds. And it seems tragic. And the fact is, we have these sensory organs, and everything that we perceive is fleeting. So we have, there's sight and there's sound and there's taste, all these different experiences that we have, and they all simply vanish. We have these wonderful experiences, and then they vanish and they slip away. And this is not to deny the reality of the beauty aspects of the beautiful aspects of life, but it's also recognizing that we're mortal beings. And this form that we embody now will soon not be here. And everything that we valued and all the beliefs that we had and the sort of the things we fought over and perhaps went to war over even, and all those beliefs and perceptions that will disappear with this body. Because those beliefs and perceptions only existed in our minds, and somehow we didn't recognize that. And loved ones that we held so dear and that we cherish and that we do care for, there's no question. But inevitably we part from them. And that's not a bad thing, it's simply the way it has to be. It was meant to be this way. This is the way it is. And the heart which longs for security and wants promises of happiness, that's something that's not to be found in this realm of existence, in human existence. And there's no certainty, there's no security anywhere. And when it comes times to die, this is not, I don't mean to be too depressing here, but when it comes time to die, all the things that we kind of occupied ourselves with, things like sports, just think about how meaningless it is when you're on your deathbed and you're taking your last few breaths. Who could care less who won the Stanley Cup, you know? And even people who kind of maybe surround us at the time of death, if that's maybe the case, they fade away into the background as we encounter our own fear and as we encounter the reality of losing the body. And there's nothing that loved ones and partners and children and parents can do. It's time, when it's time to go, it's time to go. And that means, what that means for the heart, which is longing for something ultimate, that means that there's nothing ultimate in this temporary conditioned realm. There's nothing that we can find that gives us security. And there's no promises. And we can even use our imagination and go a step further. I mean, we've been all blessed, everyone in this room, with being born into a culture which is actually at this time, whether it's gotten here through moral means or not, the bottom line is there's space, there's peace. And we have wealth, we have clothes. We're in a room which is heated and protected from the elements, and that's much more than many, many people on this planet can say. And it's a mystery. You start thinking about it, it seems insane how much injustice there is in the world. And people have been fighting injustices ever since we stood upright from being animals. And there's still no sign of it abating. And that's not to say we shouldn't fight injustice, it's just that it's a part of the human condition. So when you reflect on this and you see that, you know, suffering is actually, it's not a small thing. And there are people who are born into suffering from day one, and that's the way it's going to be until the last breath. And why are we not them? That's something to ask yourself. And it should humble us. It should humble us and say, you know, what we have can't be all that important. Because if it was important, that would be just a profound insult to those who don't have such amenities. So the Four Noble Truths, then, to me, it's when I say it's the truth of the way things are. It's not some kind of dogmatic belief that we have to believe in. It's about a truth of the heart and the relationship between selfishness and suffering that we can see and understand, I think, quite easily, and it goes quite deep. And it's also quite superficial. You can see it on superficial levels as well, just how suffering causes conflict. I'm sorry, how selfish craving creates conflict, creates injustice, and creates alienation, creates loneliness. And the way to be free from suffering in the Four Noble Truths the Buddha teaches is the Eightfold Path. And that Eightfold Path, put simply, and I'll summarize it briefly, starts with virtue. Say for lay people, the five precepts is like a foundation for spiritual practice. And the five precepts is kind of like a container. So the five precepts do bring happiness, but we have to be realistic. If you've been, say, not keeping the five precepts, let's say you're a heavy drinker, and you suddenly decide you're going to stop drinking, you shouldn't expect it to bring happiness straight away. I mean, it's painful. And all that kind of craving that went into aspects of your experience, and you channeled it into alcohol, now you've got to just simply hold that craving, and that the craving and the longing for, in this case, just to be drunk. And that can last for years sometimes after you stop drinking. I remember a monk that I was living with, he'd been in the ropes for 7 years, and he says, he looks at me one afternoon, and he goes, it's amazing, you know, 7 years I'm still craving vodka. So when you start keeping the precepts, you can understand how the precepts are obviously an essential ingredient to a peaceful heart. But it's also the case that it's like it's a container that once you kind of start to embody, it takes a while for you to kind of stand upright in that space and for you to feel at peace in that space. But in that space, this is the key to the five precepts, is that you're not harming anybody. And because of that, the natural karmic consequence of that is harm doesn't come to you. And just like the alcoholic who stops drinking alcohol, it may take years sometimes before he starts to feel peaceful. Well, even keeping the five precepts, there may still be all kinds of tragedies that come to you. And let's say you've been abusive and then you stop being abusive. Well, people may still perceive you as being abusive, even though you're not anymore. You may have abandoned that intention, but people have memories and they'll project onto you what they remember, what they have in their memories. And that may take time for you to rebuild trust. But it's through keeping the five precepts, through keeping a commitment to the virtue, that trust, this is the foundation of trust, basically, is being trustworthy. It's pretty, seems kind of obvious. But it's some, for some reason, we don't seem to see it. So this is the first stage of, say, Buddhist practice, is learning how to live within the five precepts, or the precepts that we undertake. For monastics, it's similar. We just simply have much more, the refinement of the precepts are much greater. So the container is much, in many ways, much smaller. But the peace and the freedom that comes from it is much more complete. But also, that also takes time. It's just like, again, like the alcoholic. You can't just come into the robes and expect suddenly, you know, you're going to be blissed out. It takes time. It can take years. It can take decades even. But if you look at it clearly and you think about it thoroughly, it's got to be a natural karmic consequence of undertaking precepts and disciplines and acts of renunciation. The result of that is the ability to be free. It's a freedom. It's a sense that the heart is not pushed around and driven through its various cravings that are cultivated in the world. And that's why we have so many different little rules that we keep as monks, is that it helps to create a container where we can see the movements of the mind more clearly and recognize that which causes suffering. And it takes time, definitely takes time. So we have to be patient and have faith in the principle above all. So that starts with the virtue, and then the second practice, or the second stage, if you will, is meditation or samadhi. And this is where we train the mind. Even if we can keep the precepts, we still might have a mind which is very restless, which is very kind of distracted, which just wants to be distracted by life. You know, all we want is just distract us till we die. This is what I think I can almost, I sense sometimes in people and in myself even to a certain extent. It's just, let me not know and think about things too deeply and let the days pass by and let that be good enough. And in meditation training, what we're doing is we're training the mind to deepen its contentment so that the contentment does not rely on external supports. But the mind can actually is trained to simply feel, to let go in a way that the mind can be still and feel complete. And it doesn't need anything. It doesn't have to go out from itself. It can just be, it can just sit here, be with the breath, be with a very simple object. And the freedom, where the freedom comes from, specifically where the freedom comes from, is letting go through all those little attachments. It's almost a physical, every attachment that we have almost has a physical manifestation. You can almost feel a knot that corresponds to an attachment. And this is where the very intense, sometimes very intense rapture and joy it comes from, meditation comes from, is the fact that we've let go of that craving and that thirst and that demand on the heart to pursue something and to get something. So that's samadhi. But then the highest, the third stage of practice, if you will, is wisdom or understanding. And even that sort of happiness that comes from the mind which is still, and the mind which is content, that's not a real freedom, because there can still be, there will be, in fact, defilements and sources of greed and hatred which can be buried very, very deep in the heart, but will only arise in certain conditions. This is why the teachers in Thailand, the masters in Thailand, will sometimes almost warn about the dangers of meditation and samadhi, because the mind can be so still. It can just, very easily one can think one's enlightened, because there's just no greed, there's no hatred, there's a clarity of mind, the mind is bright, it's buoyant, and you can think, you know, this mind is absolutely purified, there's nothing here, there's nothing I want, there's total peace, and I can't see how this will be shaken. But what might be the case, in fact it usually is the case, is that on a deeper level, it's just there's change the conditions. You know, take away the monastery, take away the seclusion, put yourself in more challenging conditions, and suddenly hatred might arise. So this is where wisdom, we have to use investigation. What it is that the Buddha teaches is the supreme attachment, as it were, in our life is actually this physical body that we seem to think we are. This form is what we have identified with. And there's no reason we should identify with this body. I mean, it's just simply that this body has kind of emerged from the womb, and there's been sense contact. And eventually a name is given to us, and we start to recognize a name. That's an incredibly mysterious process. I mean, the sense of self and how we identify with this body, how unfair it would be if this body were really me. What a tragedy that would be. I mean, think about somebody, again, let's just say born in Africa, into a family that's totally poor. And if that were them and this were me, and those were real realities, what a tragic world this would be. But fortunately, what the Buddha teaches is actually this body doesn't belong to us. And this is simply, it's a process of sensory contact, which is moving through time and space. And it's through its contacts, some are pleasant, some are painful. It creates values, it creates love, creates conflict. And it's based fundamentally on the identification with this body. So that we think this body is us, we think it belongs to us. And based on that, the whole of samsara turns. So we investigate the body. And we do this with the foundation of the joy, the peace and tranquility that comes from samadhi. And we investigate, what is this body? You know, why is it here? What does it mean to die? What is death? What are the implications? What does it mean that this body could die tomorrow? You know, it really could. And that's not just some sort of intellectual exercise. That's a very real possibility. There's been two monks in our Sangha in Thailand. Two monks. One was in his early 30s, and I think the other was in his late 30s. It seems that both who have died in the robes through some kind of freak accident, through just simply falling. One was in the bathroom and the other was just on a path, just kind of fell down, and one broke his neck and the other, I can't remember, but they just fell down and died. And if you think about this community here, there's 20 of us, 20 monastics, over the next 20 years, if you keep up this number, statistically speaking, one of us probably, it's going to happen. And it's just going to be a freak accident. None of us will have been expecting it. And suddenly it's just like one day we wake up and, you know, car accident, or, you know, Ajahn Yadiko has a heart attack. And no one's expecting it. And chaos would ensue. No. But nobody would be, this is the thing, is that we should really take this seriously. And not so as we can freak ourselves out, but so we can say, right, you know, this is a way to cut through distraction. This is a way to cut through to our own commitment to something meaningful. And so all of this, what I've just communicated here, the precepts, the sense restraint that embodies the precepts from the monks, the meditation, the investigation, the way things are, this is what the Dhamma is. And when we take refuge in the Dhamma, we're saying, yes, truth exists, not as some kind of metaphysical truth, but truth is that there's a reality of the way the heart works and what causes suffering, and that's real. And that's what the Buddha discovered, and that's what he taught. And that's one, someone who has faith in the Buddha has faith that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, and that he speaks. When you read his words, they resonate very deeply with me. And he's not encouraging us to believe anything. There's no absolute truths. If you go through the canon, there's nothing that he's not saying anything that this is the way it is. He's teaching a method to be free from suffering, a method to realize the way things are. So when I read the canon and read the Dhamma and study the Dhamma, I come to a sense that whoever put this collection of words together, I don't really care what you call him, but whoever put it together, this is somebody I trust. This is somebody who had a very profound insight into the nature of suffering and the meaning of human existence. And when I take refuge in the Buddha, that means what I'm saying is that, you know, I trust this being so much that I want to give my heart to follow what he taught. This is somebody who knew something special. And having taken refuge, of course, it doesn't magically mean suddenly I'm going to be enlightened, not by a long shot. I mean, there's still all the work that you have to do, but basically, it's that what I'm saying is I trust that the Buddha knew what he was saying, and that when things are difficult and confusion sets in and I'm not sure if I'm doing the right thing, I come back to the fact that, you know, the Buddha actually, he was just a human being, but he knew. He understood things. And there's something about that that gives tremendous solace to me. And I find that incredibly inspiring to think that this monastery here is simply a karmic result. It's a causal result of the Buddha's loving kindness. So he came into the world. He cared for human beings. He taught the way to be free from suffering. And he set rolling this process of liberation that is simply passed on down through the generations, and it's going to keep going until it disappears, which he also says will happen. Just like a city, no matter how great it is, no matter how great a country is, a nation, they exist, they peak, and they fade away and they disappear. And they get overgrown and they get forgotten. And that's going to happen, the Buddha says, to this teaching just like every other teaching. But because this teaching, what he was teaching was the way things are, that truth is always there. It's always accessible to those who are willing to train themselves to see it and to recognize it and to find it. And that's what the Sangha is. It's those beings who, men and women, monks, nuns, lay people of any race, it has nothing to do with race or gender. What it has to do is the human heart, which has basically taken the practice of the Buddha, committed himself to it or herself to it, and realized the fruits and has purified the heart from greed, from selfishness. Purified the heart so much from ill will that to have a thought of harming is impossible. A thought of revenge, the slightest thought of hurt is impossible for an enlightened being. And free the heart from delusion, so that the heart is freed from delusion. And there's not a trace of... It's not that he's... Not that he can't misunderstand things on a worldly level. In fact, he can be completely wrong about his conceptual understanding of issues and worldly matters. But what there is complete clarity on is what suffering is and what causes suffering and what causes the heart to be free from suffering. That is where delusion is completely gone. And whatever happens to the physical body, whatever happens to the brain, that heart, which is non-material, that heart is liberated forever from greed and from hatred, and the causes that can give rise to greed, hatred, and delusion. So the Sangha, we take refuge in the Sangha, those beings that we trust that this is a path that bears fruit. And we trust that it's borne fruit for people in this world today. And even if, frankly, even if you find that if you're not sure if you've ever met somebody who's enlightened, for me, just the knowledge that the confidence that enlightenment is possible, and that's a confidence that I do have, and it's tremendous. It's a tremendous comfort. And it gives courage, gives strength. It helps me be patient. It helps me be forgiving of my faults and mistakes, because I know this path is going in a certain direction where there is a result, and it can only be that way. This is a path that is based on causality. Causality is a key principle in the Buddhist teachings, and I trust so much that if freedom from suffering is going to come about, it's going to come about through causes. And those causes, I have a sense for what those causes are. And I have that sense because I've been studying and practicing the teachings. And those causes are just what I've said, you know, the virtue, the meditation, and the investigation. Those are the three kind of key principles that we have to commit ourselves to. So this is just a very kind of, almost like a review for all of us. Taking refuge in the Triple Gem. What is the Triple Gem? What is the Buddha? What is the Dhamma? What is the Sangha? What are we doing here? Why are we practicing? Why did you come here tonight in the cold on a Saturday night when you could be out watching movies, partying, whatever it is that people do on Saturday nights? You've come here, and there's a purpose behind that. And we're all here practicing because for a purpose. And we should be clear what that purpose is. We should try and clarify that purpose. And then commit ourselves to the path, and then be patient. And those are two very key principles as well, commitment and patience. And I'll just clarify, tonight's not Saturday night. Tomorrow's Saturday night. But it is a Friday, and you could be doing these things just as well on a Friday. So on that note, I think I'll leave this Dhamma talk with that.